Hello and welcome back to Millennial 2021. I'm now here with Last Things. Now, some of you will know him already. I discovered him, I think one of his videos was shared in MW Public, my Telegram group, a few months ago. I've been a bit detached from YouTube, as I've said before, since I got banned from there. I don't spend as much time hanging around on that platform, so I don't see new channels and discover new channels so easily. But somebody shared one of Last Things' videos, and I thought it was really good. It was a comparison of two Hollywood movies, and I think quite a lot of his videos are like that. And so I was glad to invite him, and I was glad when he accepted. Now, so welcome, Last Things, to Millennial.
Hey, Woz, it's an absolute pleasure and an honor to be here. I have to tell you, and I'm not blowing smoke. When I started my channel in 2020, and I wrote down as a personal goal, I said, I'm starting this channel in 2020. I'm getting on to Millennial in 2021. I was talking to Orrin McIntyre earlier this week, and I said to him, "Hey, man, we both made it to Carnegie Hall since."
that is lovely that people, treat Millennial with such
It's like your Broadway
reverence. It's nice, especially after being banned from YouTube. It's nice that it still has that prestige, and I hope that continues. Obviously, it would be better if it were on there, but it's nice that we have. And also, I mean, there is a certain advantage to not being on YouTube, which is that people who are on there, when they appear on this, on Odyssey, can perhaps let loose a bit. They don't need to be so worried about what they say. Because, not to go on about this again, but, it is quite stifling on YouTube nowadays. And actually, that is a point in itself. I think you represent a newer generation of content creators who have learned from the mistakes of people like me in not being as overt, not being as sometimes ideological as, the 2014, 2016 sort of people were. And I think that's good, because when things become too political, I mean, I look at my worst period when I, like 2018, and it was very, like the last videos I made before I got really burnt out with it were ridiculously I wouldn't say they're propaganda exactly, but they're very intellectually incurious, because I think by that time I felt that this is the topic, I've got to talk about this, the white this, white that. And it's, looking on it now, it's just boring. So I think it's good to remain in the realms of cultural commentary, psychology, ethics, morality, because obviously our ideas will seep through that anyway. So we'll seep through those topics and our treatment of those topics. So, and it's also just much more human. So I think that it's good that you are doing what you do. So would you like to describe for people who might not know you what kind of videos you make?
Yeah, definitely. And let me just say, we all miss you dearly on YouTube, but I do think the fact that you're on Odyssey now does give it a bit more of kind of like an underground vibe. It's like the speakeasy that you got to find.
Maybe. Yeah.
Hopefully it will give it a bit of a mystique. And I guess I don't know how conscious I've been about not stepping on any third rails. I think newer content creators, I've had a lot of conversations with other people that kind of came on the scene when I do, and we try really not to get too married to a platform or fall in love with YouTube. I think even if we're treading lightly, who knows when they're going to kind of ratchet up the sensors, but time will tell. So my channel, and I guess my nom de guerre is Last Things. I describe myself as a video essayist commenting on the pre-apocalypse. I come at things from a a sort of post-liberal dissident right perspective. I've tended to make longer form video content, and I, as you said, I've fallen into the rhythm of typically sort of pairing either a film or a TV show as scaffolding for exploring either an individual philosopher or a philosophical or political concept in depth. I think I've kind of a documentary I've always loved is Zizek's A Pervert's Guide to Cinema. And I think maybe I'm trying to offer, I guess, a post-liberal guide to cinema, except obviously I have a much, you know, higher IQ and a greater spirit than Zizek. And hopefully I slur fewer words. It's like there's less hand gestures. But I have started to supplement my channel with some interviews with other dissidents as well, just because it tends to take me a long while to edit my videos. They tend to clock in at under an hour. I guess other things to mention about my channel. So the name Last Things is a bit of a nod or an homage to First Things, the Catholic publication. While I am not myself a Catholic, I actually sort of fell into the dissident right sphere in part, a major part of, I think, my movement rightward was listening to a lot of the sort of trad-cath sphere or subsphere of the dissident right. YouTubers like Tyler Hamilton and The Distributist, I think, had a major influence on my thought. And so while I kind of remain secular, I have a great deal of sympathy for vloggers and content creators that are kind of coming from that religious background. So I figured the moniker might fit to, it's kind of a more gloomy postmodern spin on First Things, since I think that, you know, those first things that magazine is alluding to kind of tend to come last in today's culture in terms of what the culture values.
Right. And I have two questions. You said, can you say again the caption, post-liberal thoughts for the pre-apocalypse, was it?
Oh, yeah. It's just a video essayist commenting on the pre-apocalypse.
Okay. So I'd have two questions then. Pre-apocalypse, what do you mean by that? And obviously, that might be a very obvious question with a very obvious answer, but I want to hear it in your terms.
Yeah, I suppose sooner or later I'm going to have to just update that. I came up with that prior to COVID. Although my channel really kind of got off the ground during COVID, but I have not been able to shake the feeling, and I think most of us are in the same space that we're heading into a sort of a winter of our civilization. I guess it's just really a comment on the instability that I see around me, not just politically but culturally, and in the type of environments that I find myself and my family in. So, but there is still this sense of foreboding and looming nature to it. If it hadn't been for the latter seasons of Game of Thrones, I'd say something like, winter's coming, but it's not here yet. But I don't talk about that show anymore.
I still haven't seen it. I still haven't seen it, so I can't discuss it with people.
Don't bother. You know what? Don't bother. It's fine.
But I just know that everyone was disappointed by the finale. Yeah, and I know that they diverged from the books in the last two or three seasons. So there you go. That's my knowledge about Game of Thrones. This is something that I, in my trailer, back in the trailer video for my channel, back in late 2013, I was, I obviously felt the same thing then, that things were darkening, that we were heading into a winter. And you can see that in the trailer, which I think is on BitChute and Odyssey. And that trailer was designed to set the tone for the channel. And it had this stuff about, you know, ethnic violence in the cities of Britain, various forms of degeneracy, and a sense of things reaching towards a crescendo of destruction. I guess at that point I imagined, and I did think that there was going to be an ethnic civil war in Britain. They would probably be along, well, not so much civil, but religious lines more than ethnic. And I'm not sure, maybe that will happen. The way I see it now is a bit less compressed. I see it more long and drawn out, and probably being more to do with the collapse of society's systems more than ethnic strife or religious strife. But yeah. Certainly, things are still darkening. We're still looking at an apocalypse. We're still looking at the end of a civilization. And that is a very depressing thing to say. I mean, even as I say the words, and even me, and I should be used to this kind of stuff, but yeah, even I find it sad to say that we are living at the end of a civilization, that we were born in a nicer time than we will die in. This is the end of the party, you know, that things are falling apart now. But that isn't the end of the story. You know, obviously it's a seasonal thing. It's a cyclical thing. And even while things fall apart, you can be thinking about how to rebuild and how to prepare the ground so that your successors can rebuild. And I think that's probably the job that we have. That's the pre-apocalypse dealt with. You also described yourself as post-liberal. Now, again, obviously, that's I think I know what you mean. I think I know why you describe yourself that way. But can you go into it for me?
Yeah. I mean, I guess most of the time when I say post-liberal, I guess I kind of use it as a synonym for being a dissident right winger, although in my case it is a bit more apt and descriptive than that, given that I was until I guess relatively recently, and for the majority of my life, I was a lifelong shit lib. I don't know if I'm allowed to curse on Millennial, but I grew up.
Yeah. Everyone else does.
Yeah, no, I mean, I grew up in a very, very hyper-liberal part of the United States, and even a very blue part of that hyper-liberal area of the country, and just sort of my default mode growing up and throughout young adulthood was being a shit lib. And I was never somebody who was, you know, particularly interested in politics. I didn't really pay that much attention to it. I think I was more like you. I was kind of an arts and letters junkie, but really what I was still sort of categorizing myself as liberal even up to Trump's election in 2016. Get sidetracked woes, but something I've noticed, I've gotten out of the habit of asking people when they're red pilled or asking for a red pilled moment. And instead, if I'm talking to another content creator, I ask them when did they decide to put up their first video or cut their first recording, or whether it's a podcast or an article, you know, when did they go online? Because that moment tends to be a much more decisive, kind of cataclysmic moment, like we were talking about a moment ago. Whereas the act of being red-pilled is a bit like the gradual winter that we're experiencing now. It's something that happens, at least for me and a lot of people I've talked to, I could not pinpoint a red-pill moment, despite the metaphor. I think it's usually a lot less abrupt. It's just sort of, you know, I've described it on another stream as, you know, one day I was listening to Sargon of Akkad back in, you know, 2013, and then, you know, after a few years, I was just listening to the back catalog of Millennial Woes. well, reading Nick Land and and I can't really tell you when the train pulled into that station, but that's kind of how that stuff happens. But people, when they take a step to kind of move into being a content creator themselves, that tends to be something a bit more dramatic and climactic. I was certainly part of the anti-SJW, anti-woke Sargon milieu. That was kind of my steady diet of content up until Trump's presidency. And I don't know if this was like, I guess it was mostly just kind of serendipitous and odd timing, bad timing in some ways. But I think as Trump was getting elected, I think that was probably when I was discovering your content, or I was beginning to discover your content. I was pretty late in the game when it comes to that stuff. But basically at the exact same moment that all of my friends and family experienced Trump derangement syndrome is the moment that I became post-liberal. Like I started getting red-pilled the moment everybody, I honestly had a moment of surprise and panic when Trump was elected, but and I think part of what got me less panicked and more kind of curious and inquisitive was a lot of the conversations and live streams that I was experiencing at that point. And I think, you know, Sargon was kind of my main hub then, but I was noticing a lot of conversations that he was having with people to the right of him. And I would think to myself, they didn't really come out on top on that argument, or I don't think he really had a convincing response for their questions. And so I would kind of leapfrog over to the right until I woke up and here I am. So yeah. I guess that's why I would describe myself as post-liberal. I would love to get some sort of poll and figure out how many people were just sort of old school conservatives. How many people, I know there are a lot of people that were libertarians, but I would not know what slice of the pie were really just tried and true shit libs. But I will confess fully that's what I want.
What particular, could you talk about particular issues that you changed your view on? Or would you rather not?
No, I'm, you know, I'm happy to. It's, I mean, I think honestly, it's interesting that you phrase it that way, because maybe a lot of people experience it this way as well. But I think a lot of people that began to categorize themselves as classical liberals, as to sort of differentiate themselves from progressives, you know, when that real kind of schism occurred within liberalism, they would, I think, respond to that as saying, you know, it's not me that's changed. It's the world that's changed. It's everybody else that is in motion. I'm actually a solid, immovable object. And that's probably how I conceived of things for a couple of years there. Until I think I started reading a lot of the, not just, you know, Moldbug, but a lot of the kind of older political theorists, and began to, I guess my theory of the left is what evolved, and all of those arguments just started to make a lot more sense to me. But more than what's maybe unique and what's interesting about my background or my story isn't so much, you know, encountering the writers or encountering the vloggers that I did. I think it's kind of interesting when it happened to me, but my environment at the time, I got red-pilled in 2016, right around when Trump was elected. And that's also the time that I decided to buy property in my ultra progressive area of ultra progressive region of my country. And it's when around the time my wife and I started our family. And as we sort of, you know, began our life, you know, our nice bourgeois middle-class life in this, this ultra-liberal community, these are the evolutions and the steps that are happening in my life, as I am listening to Woes, as I am reading, you know, The Italian Elite School, and you can probably fill in the blanks.
Yes.
And I began to notice a lot of things in this community. So we bought this house in this very sort of picturesque community. We fell in love with it because it seemed like the perfect place to raise kids and start a family. It's a bit of, I don't know if you have sort of planned communities or intentional communities, or if those terms make sense to you in Europe, but it's sort of like its own neighborhood. It's, it's got, several dozen houses, but it's settled back in the woods. So there's nature, there's sort of a quad that has a playground, and there's common spaces, there's community buildings. And, when we found it, it just seemed like the most bucolic, pastoral setting to raise a family. But, as I kind of got acclimated to the environment, as I got to know the community more and more and experience it, I these words of, I don't know if you're a Tolstoyan woes or if you've ever read Anna Karenina, but the first lines, the first sentence of Anna Karenina kept haunting me. They're quite famous. I'm paraphrasing them, or they've been translated different ways, but essentially it's, all happy families are alike, and all unhappy families are unhappy in their own unique way. I plan to do a video on just that line, because I think in some ways it's the most reactionary sentence that's ever been written. But it's something that it kept kind of pounding in my head as I would observe my community, because this was really like, it ought to be a place for people to raise children, and yet of the dozens of houses, only three of them were with families that had small children. Two of them, other than myself, got divorced in the time that I lived there. And it was kind of, every household, and again, this is a diehard progressive community. There's BLM signs on every lawn. And you need to picture me, parking my car, walking past these BLM signs on the way to my house as I'm listening to, some audiobook about how Protestantism gave birth to wokeism. It's just the evidence. It's just up in front of my face, and it's just true. And I mean, I don't take any pleasure in saying this, but I just would notice, these different forms of sort of failed, failed families, failed marriages, and unhappiness, and really the de facto, noticing for the first time the de facto religious nature of progressivism within the community. My community was hyper paranoid, even more paranoid than the rest of my state about COVID. And the only thing that convinced people to finally kind of commune or get together in the same building was a social justice book club where people started reading Robin DiAngelo's White Fragility. And really everything within
God, that, I just can't imagine how boring that would be.
My wife had to like basically strap me to the bed like The Exorcist, because I wanted to go in as just like a sleeper agent and then, start slowly like putting, red pills in people's tea bags or something. But I did not wind up doing that. But, not only that, there's just, I don't know. This is probably another concept that you as a Scotsman might not have ever heard of. Do you know what a land acknowledgement is?
This to do with native rights, presumably.
Oh, you do? Okay. You're schooled in this. Yeah. So we've paid, I think we paid something like, $500 for a Native American to come and perform some sort of ritual that permits us to inhabit this property. Basically everything within the community is this. This is a phrase that I learned and I owe to Gio Panichetti, who's another great, great vlogger, if he's never been on Millennial, but a counter initiation. He was talking about, he's an art critic, and he was talking about the idea of counter initiations. He was using it to talk about sort of anti-sacred or desacralized art, and a lot of sort of feminist art is often stuff that plays with these kind of religious imagery and iconography and themes as a way of performing a kind of satanic counter initiation. And I just noticed everything in my community was this sort of counter. It is the de facto religion, the de facto communal nature of everything is this worship of the other, and this this white guilt, and this sort of
that is terrible to think that people having a culture whose main thrust is to negate their existence.
Yeah.
And the idea of them having a culture.
Yeah. And I could not, for the life of me, I wanted to, be attending a lot of, community gatherings, but anything and everything that was attempted to be organized would always be in some way, it didn't feel right. It was in some way organized around these counter-initiations.
And presumably this is something that your neighbors are doing themselves. I mean, it's not like there's some, or maybe there is, you tell me, is there some person with a, slightly German-sounding name arriving in your community and organizing these events for you? Or is this something that your neighbors are doing?
They're all very, very into it. I mean, and, a lot of them are baby boomers, and their millennial children are well into their mid to late 30s, but aren't getting married and aren't having kids, and so they're kind of sad that they aren't grandparents. And I think that in some ways there's this it's sort of something that sweeps. I think it certainly takes the place of religion, but I think it's also something that kind of normally I think people have these extended families, or they're dealing with grandkids at an earlier age, but now there's just sort of these extended periods in life where you have grown kids, but they're just enjoying the hedonism of young adulthood.
Yeah, extended adolescence into their 20s and 30s. Something that you said earlier was that the essentially religious nature of progressivism.
Mm.
And then you also said that the book club, it was the only thing that you could motivate people to get together, was a book club where they would discuss feminist literature. What was the book? Fragility. So anti-white books. I mean, that is interesting because presumably they were motivated to go to that because they knew they would receive religious indoctrination or religious teaching at this book club.
Yeah. It's just, I guess to tie back to your original question, I think it's just, after a few years of this, I just sort of began to notice the God-shaped hole that existed in the community. And this is the kind of stuff that was filling that hole. It is this strange kind of desire and this pull for a form of communion. But it's this counter communion. And I'm sure all of them pat themselves on the back for being, an incredibly secular bunch. And yet
they're not. See, this is what's so fascinating about the absence, the absence of religion. The post-Christian world is a deeply religious world, the progressive world. And now with COVID, I think there's a deeply religious tone to all of this. I suspect that the Great Reset, part of that will be providing people with a new, it won't be called a religion, but it will certainly function as a religion. Part of it might be the ritual of declaring your carbon offset, your carbon improvements you've made there, discussing how you can be a better ally to trans people and to people of color, displaying your virtue, but not just to make yourself feel good, like warm fuzzies in the moment, but actually to prove that you really are a good person. Not just the thrill of virtue signaling, but actually, like, seriously, don't worry. I really am a good. I really do deserve to be loved. I please don't condemn me. I think that there is I've thought this for a long time, that there is a clear need for religion in people in general, and this is why the new atheists of the 2000s made me sick, because I hated that their nihilism, that they were pleased and happy that there was no God. But also, on a completely separate note, I hated that they were leaving people defenseless and naked. Because they were taking away from the masses something that the masses clearly need. And that has been shown by the way that they latch on to things like climate change, progressivism, and now COVID.
I mean, I will have to admit woes to a period in my life where I was.
I would worry about it. So was I at one point. I remember watching a Richard
new atheist conferences or anything like that. But you know, before YouTube really took off, I would just listen to Christopher Hitchens.
I remember once watching a Richard Dawkins documentary and laughing out loud at something he said. So presumably, I must have been. For a brief period, there must have been some period where I was up for that stuff, and you know, the new atheism and how ridiculous Christianity is and all that. But it must have been a very short period, because my prevailing memory is thinking, this is shit. This is shitty. It's nasty. It's nihilistic. And so I grew out of that amusement quite quickly, I think. I'm just piecing it together. I must have done.
I think your content actually is part of what helped me, I guess, step out of that that phase happily.
It feels like you're being clever when you laugh along with Hitchens, and I don't want to talk about Christopher Hitchens. I don't want to get into that, because there's a lot. I really despise him. I really dislike him intensely. Richard Dawkins just strikes me as a sort of buffoon, whereas I think Hitchens was actually quite a nasty guy. An egomaniac. Either way, the new atheism thing, after a brief period of finding it funny and clever, I concluded that it was empty and poisonous and destructive, and I remember falling out with a friend over it. Like, he was celebrating that something that one of them had said. I think Dawkins or Sam Harris or something. And I remember thinking, that's not good. But anyway, the point is that I would say that what's happened since then, since 2010, has demonstrated that intuition on my part and on many people's part was correct. That the new atheism thing was unhealthy, it wasn't helpful, and it hasn't held. It hasn't lasted. This is why nobody talks about these people anymore. I mean, no one cares. It's, you know, to see, so there's a guy I went onto Facebook a few days ago, and there's a guy there who's sharing these memes, like that I'm guessing are from at least 10 years ago. And it's like, it's bizarre. I mean, I haven't seen these things shared for ages. Like Richard Dawkins quotes, you know, infographics, that kind of thing, and Ricky Gervais, that sort of thing. So it hasn't held, and it has quickly been supplanted. And so you now have people believing in climate change, LGBT, BLM, COVID. This is a deeply religious age. It's just that hasn't been made formal yet. You know, there's no state religion of COVID. There's no state religion of LGBT.
Yeah, but give
it time. In the meantime, it's just something that people are grasping for. They want it.
Yeah, and I guess, I mean, part of what, I guess maybe the difference, at least for me with this stuff, is it's a religion without any salvation or any any ultimate forgiveness or transcendence, which is probably why I kind of got into the habit of listening to a lot more religious vloggers around this time. I think we're in maybe a similar position. Woes. It's something I wanted to talk to you about or ask you about at some point. If I'm not mistaken, at least at one point, I remember from some of your videos, you would consider yourself as maybe I'm coining this phrase, but like trad adjacent. Like I don't think either of us are religious, and yet we are sort of, I guess.
Yeah, I've never used that term. Because I only became aware of the adjacent suffix quite recently, only about a year ago, I think. And I quite like it. It's quite elegant. But I haven't described myself that way, but it is accurate, yes. I wish I could be religious. I just can't be. I just can't convince myself that God is real. But I think in my nature, I'm very religious. And that's not to say that I'm very, you know, moral or perfect or whatever, but I think that there is, you know, I'm not going to name names, but there are people who claim to be religious and I like Catholic or whatever. And I think, no, I'm more religious than you. Because the people in question, I strike me as, you know, shallow, supercilious, insincere, not taking anything seriously, really. But they will know all about, you know, Catholicism or whatever. And I don't know anything about Catholicism, but I feel that my appreciation of life has a religious tone to it. Let's put it that way.
It's funny. I was having a conversation with a friend of a friend a little while ago who is who is Catholic in the sense that they were raised Catholic. And, you know, they go to church every Sunday, but they're also this, you know, like urban cosmopolitan sexual libertine, you know, unmarried, but kind of getting up there, but it lives the lifestyle is, completely commensurate and compatible with every single, secular urbanite, in their milieu. And explaining to me over a beer that, like, you know, his priest in his parish was openly gay, and so were most of the priests that he knew within his like greater community. But like he had this whole shtick, and the shtick was basically just like, it was this song and dance routine to convince me that there's nothing about being Catholic that is not synonymous with just being a bourgeois, secular, depraved individual. Like, I got mad at him. I got out of his face. I was like, why are you attempting to prove to me, like, either your religion is a counterpoint to modernity or it's not. And if it is, good for you. There's no need for you to apologize or to like make up any excuse or rationalize it to me. But if it isn't, and you're just as sort of, you know, unrestrained as anyone else that we were having this conversation with, then why do it? You know, I felt offended at how bad a Catholic this guy was. It does get, I mean, it does, you know.
I know, it's like, why are you LARPing? Why are you lying?
Yeah.
Sort of thing. Yeah, I understand. I think this might be something that's more of a problem or a phenomenon in America, because there's still I think there's still more of a pressure to be religious in America than there is, I might be wrong, but in Britain, you know, no one, Christianity is just really out, it's just gone, you know.
Really?
Yeah, there's no sense of. I mean, when I was at school, the assemblies every Wednesday at like junior school, primary school, they were Christian. You know, we sang hymns. That's just unimaginable now. To fit in with what I was saying earlier, I'm certain that the assemblies they have now at that school will be progressivism.
Yeah, yeah.
It will be the religion of, you know, now, of this time.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, it's funny, you know, I guess being a an ally to the religious, you know, members of the dissident right. It gets weirder and more awkward the older you get. Woes. I think I might be a bit older than you, but at the very least, I'm I am a parent. You know, and one thing that this is another. I'll give you one other kind of funny anecdote. So I in recent months I've been reaching out to a lot of different like local Catholic dioceses, and I've been trying to volunteer and work on getting. I'm trying to create grassroots movements to establish some like classical ed schools in the style of you know old school Catholic educations that teach like the Trivium and you know you learn your Greek and your Latin like you know pre like old school
how to think kind of stuff.
Yeah, and I've been in touch with all of these priests and all of these higher ups within multiple dioceses within counties where I live. And at some point I'm actually not Catholic, but they're like, then why are you trying to work with me to get a Catholic school established in, like, I'm like, can I just get my kids in there? Can I just, like, because they're like, they don't know what to do with me. They start looking at me like I'm completely insane.
Yeah, you see, I understand exactly what you mean. So you're Catholic adjacent. I understand. I can imagine doing the same thing myself, because the alternative is to facilitate or to do nothing to oppose, rank satanic progressivism.
Yeah, and I hate to be in a position where. But I will say, I think that, like, you know, I've had some communications that were going well, sort of, you know, slowly peter out. I think when, you know, I am upfront about the fact that I'm secular, they're, you know, initially perplexed, and then they sort of back away from the involvement. But I'm it'll be interesting to see how that evolves. I think I've heard the Distributist and some other Christian, you know, vloggers talk about how there is going to be this, I think, necessity for Christians to kind of lock arms with a lot of people like ourselves who maybe if we can't ourselves be believers, where I'm willing to defer our culture back to the, back to the Christians.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think so. I mean, obviously, some people watching this will object to this. Then some people watching this will be pagans. I doubt that many people watching this will be, you know, avowed atheists. But I do have quite a lot of pagan followers, and you know, I've got nothing against paganism. I just don't see it as realistic. I mean, I'm not sure that Christianity is a realistic prospect either. But I think it's. And again, in Europe, there is the third option of Islam. And it's incredible to be saying this, you know, because, you know, my early videos were very concerned about Islam and the rise of Islam in Europe. But now I sometimes do wonder, I'll be honest, I sometimes do wonder is Islam the only bulwark against nihilism, against the abyss. I hope it isn't. But what I would say is, there is the possibility that if it did get adopted in Europe, it would be Europified. It wouldn't be the Arab version that we know of, famously. It would be adapted. But I'm not sure. This is something where you just cannot predict how this is going to shake out. But yeah, someone's just said paganism is our heritage. I have no problem with it. It is our culture. I agree. I'd agree with that. And I'm curious about paganism. I'm not against it at all. But I think that in the meantime, Christianity seems more, and I hate to say it because it sounds like I'm choosing products off a shelf.
Sure.
I don't mean it that way. I just know that whichever one of these things wins out, I'm probably not going to be a believer. You know, if paganism wins, I'm probably not going to be a pagan. If Christianity wins, I'm probably not going to be a Christian. So, and if Islam wins, I'm probably not going to be a Muslim. That seems very strange idea. So it's not that I'm choosing it. I'm just saying what would be best. You know, I'm trying to judge this. What would be preferable?
It's interesting to hear you mention paganism and Catholicism. You know, broadly speaking, I guess this is maybe kind of lowering the focus a bit outside of just, you know, Catholicism or, you know, genuine practicing pagans. But I've talked about this on a few other streams, but it does seem to me like sort of the two wolves of the dissident right now are things that you could kind of broadly juxtapose or categorize as Christianity and paganism, or I think I've often heard it described as Nietzsche and Christ, people that kind of are interested in Bronze Age pervert to me is to just the avatar and the persona of the, I guess, pagan right. I mean, he probably wouldn't call himself a pagan, but that sort of vitalist, pre-Christian, Dionysian,
I know what you're getting at. I know. Yeah.
And I've been just kind of, you know, scratching my head because they seem like such sort of opposite forces. But I was listening to a stream a couple weeks ago with Joel Davis, and he was talking about this guy Dumazil, who I guess is he's a historian of Indo-European culture. And one thing that they were talking about on this stream was, I guess there are three kind of old primary Jungian archetypes that are present in a lot of these Indo-European religions. And the three archetypes are the priest, the warrior, and the merchant. And a lot of I'm going to do a terrible job of kind of paraphrasing this stuff, but part of what they were describing to me on this stream was that, I guess, a constant sort of narrative that is described within these religions is that the priest and the warrior often ally with one another in some way, shape, or form to make sure that the merchant is never ascendant, or the merchant never really takes power. You know, even though the priest and the warrior are these very kind of opposing forces, they do join together in a lot of these, I guess, ancient myths and ancient rituals within Indo-European culture to make sure that the merchant is never ascendant. And I was listening to that and I jumped in my seat because I was like, that is, I mean, one, the merchant is ascendant right now in the world.
Oh, and yeah.
That to me describes exactly I don't even want to call it a schism, because I think there's a lot of like cross-pollination and camaraderie, but this, I guess, light division on the dissident right between the warrior and the priest. The last thing I'll say about, though, I mean, I have a lot of affection for the pagans and the Nietzscheans. It's just like, it's hard to be a Bronze Age pervert after you have a baby seat in the, like, the back of your, like, you know, station wagon. That's it's fun. Yeah. It's a lot easier to be that kind of dissident right winger before you kind of settle down a bit in life,
and then you just want sanity and stability. I can understand. One thing about the merchant and the warrior and the priest, I would say that America in the 20th century represents the merchant, the obviously taking precedence, and it's all about money, it's all about materialism, it's all about capitalism, it's all about selling things. But that isn't the end of the story, because, as I say, we've now got, with the various forces in our society, COVID, progressivism, I guess you could say that's a new priest has arrived. But it works hand in hand with the merchant, because part of this new religion is that everyone is interchangeable, that there are no roots, that everyone is a product, and everyone can choose their lifestyle. Their lifestyle is a product. just one of different options on the supermarket shelf. That materialist mindset permeates even the priest now. Yeah, it's an interesting analogy. But I do think that for a long time, and you know, you'll get right wingers who seem to believe in nothing but the free market. You know, it's just let the merchant have his way, and that's not a coded dog whistle or anything. I mean, that seems to be what they think. Just let the free market do its thing, and that will make people free and wealthy and prosperous, as if that's all there is to life. And again, the boomers seem to really have internalized that. That seems to be their thing. But again, as you said, in your community, a lot of them are boomers, and they're going for the progressivism now.
You know,
even they are needing something more than the merchant can offer.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I feel like I'm channeling one of my, trad Cath friends here. I think if they were on the stream with us, they'd say something like, you know, well, ultimately there are these kind of religious elements to wokeism and progressivism. It is a counter religion or a heresy at the end of the day. And even if they have the, there is a priestly quality, or there's a religious quality to this stuff, especially with the kind of COVID death cult. It is sort of, if you were looking at a tarot card, it's the upside down priest. There's some counter initiative to the ritual, to the religiosity of it.
Yes.
Or the other term that gets batted around a lot is Gnosticism. And they would say it's a Gnostic heresy, I think. Religiosity of it for a minute.
Yeah, I've also heard it just described as satanic. I mean, it's religious in its potential, but not quite in its nature. I think that's true.
Speaking of Satan and returning to my community woes, I should tell you, one of the things that I did before I did my first video. And I think it was my first video was just a response of this growing sense of claustrophobia with my community. I have written a sequel. I wrote a script to a horror film, and this should be the sequel to Jordan Peele's Get Out. If you are listening, Jordan Peele, and I know you tune into every millennial, I know you're here. I have got a script that would be the spiritual sequel to Jordan Peele's Get Out, which would be just about a ultra progressive boomer community and like a young white family that buys a house in the neighborhood, and it turns out that they all just want to like sacrifice the children of this white family on some sort of sacrificial altar of white guilt. Like, we had a scene where there was where basically the land acknowledgement becomes like something out of Rosemary's Baby.
Yeah.
And like father, who's obviously me in the script that I wrote, is just like, he keeps getting this weird vibe. Like I'm Rosemary in my screenplay of the neighbors, you know, they're just always kind of acting really, really weird. And then like one day they're just like, come, like, you know, why don't you come to this, see this, you know, Native American shaman and, you know, bring the kids.
And I think, oh my God,
I think if we brought it to Cannes Film Festival woes, we would get the Palme d'Or. You want an end of the Kali Yuga? It's my movie idea.
Maybe not Cannes, but definitely the Oscars. I mean, it sounds terrifying, but you know, I don't honestly think it's that unrealistic. And this is part of the thing. Obviously, because the media is part of the programming, part of the brainwashing, it cannot honestly reflect on the brainwashing. It can't even show it. It can't depict it. So you will never get a film that shows what life actually is like in 2021. That's never going to happen. You'll get a heavily skewed thing about some black person being victimized by whites or whatever. Or how awful it is being a Muslim in today's Britain, because we're all so racist. but you'll never actually see this is actually one of the things that depresses me about the age we live in, that we're never, that there is never going to be the creative artistic treatment of it that absolutely should happen.
Yeah.
Because we don't have the funding, we don't have the resources, we don't have the connections, we don't have the distribution systems. It's not going to happen. But there's so much in it that's interesting and that deserves to be reflected upon. For example, when is there ever going to be a drama that shows some, let's say, some middle-aged woman discovering her purpose in life when she puts on the COVID mask for the first time?
Hmm.
But there absolutely bloody well should be, because that I'm certain that has happened. I'm certain that in the real world, that's what's actually going on. But they could never show that because it would give the game away. You know, it would be too explicit. It's like you can't explicitly state what is going on here, because then it might all fall apart.
I agree. Yeah, like there should be some sort of film school that has been, evolving over the past decade that would be, eventually canonized and part of the Criterion collection. And it would be, our version of the, the generation under the influence 1960s film directors, but instead of, sexual revolution, cultural revolution films, it would just be, the social horror of wokeism. And I think grok what you're getting at, Woz. Like, we are in desperate need of an artistic renaissance, and it is sad to know that we just don't have the. We need like a MacArthur grant or something.
Yeah. Well, as ever, we need our Soros. We need our own billionaire to fund this stuff.
I will say, I think there's a lot of great. I mean, a film is a different story because it's just so. So expensive to pull off. But I mean, I think that H.P. Lovecraft is doing, Homeric work with his fiction. There are, I think, a few glimmers in the darkness, so to speak, when it comes to artistic creativity on the distant right. And I think that I'm a lot less black-pilled on creativity and an artistic movement coming out of the dissident right than I am community building on the dissident right, to be quite honest. I'm seeing a lot more promise artistically than I am in a lot of community building efforts.
Well, that was obviously something that you wanted to talk about. We should probably go for about another 15 minutes, by the way, so we don't have that long, because next I've got Ryan Turnipseed coming on. But I do think that is a problem, and it always has been. And, as I was saying earlier on tonight, there are problems with the distant right that I think attend any fringe politics, which is that it attracts a lot of people. I'm not saying all of them by any means, but a certain fraction of the distant right are people who are antisocial, who are disagreeable, who aren't cooperative. And thus you get problems. You get serious problems trying to form a cohesive community, even online. I mean, every day I ban people from my Telegram group, not just for the sake of it. It's not like I just randomly do that, but there are troublemakers. You have to do that all the time. So in a real life community, it'd be even more difficult. But yeah. I don't know exactly what you mean by community building.
I think that's actually part of the challenge, because I think that really people mean they mean one of three things. I think community building gets mentioned a lot on the right, and it's very easy for people to be kind of talking past one another in that regard. There's really sort of three forms of community building. And I don't mean to disparage any of these. I think one, type one is simply online spaces, networking with people online. Discord servers have often a limited lifespan, but wherever and however people congregate online. I think that that's, you know, necessary and great. And we need people supporting any and every one of these types of communities. I think the second thing that people mean when they talk about community is more along the lines of, I guess, sort of circling the wagons with the normies, right? Like, which maybe depending on where you are in the world, you know, I don't know what it's like, you know, where you live woes, but this honestly, this particular, I guess, brand of advice is something that always gets on my nerves and gets me angry. I always see at least once a week somebody on Twitter saying some dissident on Twitter saying the equivalent of, like, you know, the first step in community building is putting down the phone and stepping outside. And every time I encounter that, I want to throw my phone, because it's not true. Like, me putting down my phone and stepping outside is to be confronted with 500 BLM signs and a land acknowledgement. It is not me stepping away from technology. I think, like, honestly, the saddest paradox and the strangest part of, you know, being alive in this historical epoch is that, you know, everyone that I'm close to physically, you know, within meat space, within the physical world, is only willing to celebrate community in the form of this worship of the other, or this counter initiation. Whereas everyone and anyone who I think would be interested in celebrating, like, a shared culture based on the actual, you know, characteristics and particularities and values of a, you know, particular community, is all scattered to the world and only exists online. So I find it just so tiresome and frustrating when people offer this platitude that, you know, real community just starts when you step away from your computer.
Yes.
Maybe if you're in the States, maybe if you're in the Deep South, that's true. I doubt it's true for you. I doubt it's true for a lot of dissident right-wingers, or we wouldn't have been driven online to begin with. And sorry to go on for at such length, but the third type of community building, I think, is, and this is honestly the one that I just, maybe I'm blind to it, but has not been explored, but it is real, honest to goodness, you know, in real life community development, where people try to kind of move into a shared physical space. And, you know, I know that probably sounds, I guess I've gotten a little bit frustrated with this as well, because I've heard a lot of people say, you know, that's something that's going to happen, but, you know, but we're in early days. I think that's kind of a refrain I hear on the dissident right at all. And I started to push back on that a bit, because I guess for one thing, a lot of people, when Trump got elected, said, he's just going to buy us 4 years. He's just going to buy us a bit of time. And what did people do with that time? I don't think much, at least. I didn't learn of any communities that got developed in that amount of time. And then we got hit with COVID. And granted, I think maybe on the surface, you might say COVID presents a serious obstacle, but, and I'm sure it does for some people, but I guess one side effect of COVID, at least in the States, was there was this massive, incredible exodus. Like, the housing market is crazy right now, because there were just, you know, tens of anybody who was, like, you know, a PMC or, you know, part of the managerial class in San Francisco or Boston or Seattle just, like, fled the cities. And there are dozens of countries. If you do any sort of, like, you know, technology, like, or, you know, information economy job, you are basically given permission to live anywhere you want. And at least it hasn't crossed my radar that any, you know, reactionary or dissident right individuals took advantage of that and said, and I'm not talking about, like, I don't want to sound woes, like I want people to form, like, a Waco compound in Nevada or, like, in the, like, hills of Montana and, like, declare that, you know, that we're our independent monarchy. But, like, I would have It would make my millennial. It would make my New Year's and my Christmas to just hear that, you know what, there were four dissident right families who all moved to the same county as a result of COVID, and they're all, you know, collectively homeschooling their kids. You know, like, I think just small grassroots efforts like that, if they didn't happen during Trump and they didn't happen during COVID, like, what is it precisely? And I'm sorry, I don't mean for this to be a black pill. I know I'm sounding way too cynical, and we only want white pills on millennial, but I just, like, what is the catalyst going to be for people to begin to try and formulate communities in some space and online?
One thing I would say is that there is one thing I've heard about. I don't want to name it, but there are several people I know who have all moved to the same town. At least three families. I'm not sure how many, but it's at least three. And you know, they've all moved to the same town in a certain state in America. That's one thing. Now, obviously, that doesn't mean that they are now in control of the town and there's a wall going up around it.
But I think it's a huge. I think that's a huge victory. Like, I would breathe 10 times easier if I just knew I had four families that were just. They don't even have to be like, you know, people that like watch Millennial every year, but just like four families that are diehard woke skeptics in my community. That would be a huge victory.
Yeah, I'm sure it would be. I mean, I think this is something where the networking is obviously going to happen online. And what it will mean is getting to know people, you know, fairly well, just to ascertain that you can get along with them. You don't need to be friends with them. You don't need to have that much in common with them. You just need to be assured that they're not insane, that they're not feds, and that you could, you know, you could live close by to them happily, you know, contentedly. And then you just need to agree, okay, that there's this street here. It's got two in this town. It's got two houses that are up for sale, etc. And then you could go from there. Or eventually it could be more than two families that could coordinate that together. It really shouldn't be that difficult. I mean, there was something else that came up the other night where I can't remember what it was, but I said to the guest, I don't know which guest it was, but I said, we really should have done this by now. It should not be difficult to do this. I'm sure we could do this. Why don't we just do it? And I know what happens. It's because everyone waits for someone else to do it. That's the trouble. And it always has been the trouble. Or they expect someone to devote loads of time to it, and they won't donate anything to make it worth that person's while, which, you know, I get it. You know, the stakes are high, things are serious. People tend to think that everyone should do stuff for free, but that's not how human nature works, unfortunately. But either way, we should be able to. There are simple things like this that should be possible, and it doesn't even need to be explicitly political. You know, it's not like you don't need a neighbor who's going to have a certain symbol on a flag in his front yard for sure. You know, ideally, it wouldn't be explicitly political at all.
Entirely underground. It should be completely subterranean. Just, these are four new families that moved to town.
Yeah.
It's like they homeschool their kids and they didn't come to the land acknowledgement, but they seem nice.
Yeah. Exactly. That kind of thing. It doesn't need to be, ideological or whatever. What you're looking for is an oasis in which to raise your kids. And be assured that they're not going to be flooded with BLM crap during their formative years.
Yeah, and I mean, that stuff is like, I kind of feel I think that there's going to be a lot more conversations around this. I'm kind of I think I'm on the older side of things when it comes to to dissidents, but I think, you know, people are going to begin to form families and have kids. And, you know, I mean, this is a bit of an overstatement, but I guess part of me feels like, you know, people talk a lot about community, but until you have a community that is able to reproduce the values of that community within a second generation, and until you've raised the next generation to sort of hold certain values, you don't so much have a community as you do a club, right? Yeah. Like, you know, community, it to me means it's multi-generational. There is something that is like there's something to the values and the ethics of that community that are being handed down. And I don't think that is a bridge that the dissident right has had to cross, but it's certainly something that that we will. So I hope I'm wrong, and I hope it is early days, because I'm certainly not circling the wagon with any normies, because they're normies in the pejorative blue pilled sense, but they're certainly not normal enough that I'd want to circle my wagon next.
I understand. About a community, a community is something that persists through time. Obviously not indefinitely, but at least for a long time, you know, multiple generations. That's what a community is. That's what a proper community is. And as you say, if we can't reproduce our values in the next generation, then it's not a community. But of course, this is exactly why we want a community. It's so that we can do that. It's so that our children, and ideally our grandchildren, will not be insane, you know, globalist drones who are just waiting for the next vaccine, or the next product, or the next, you know, perverse lifestyle to latch onto. So I agree, and I think this is something that we will just have to find ways to do it.
I'm curious. Do you have? I mean, and feel free to decline to answer this question. But do you? Because I'm always very curious. I have a real fascination for a lot of kind of, UK dissident right vloggers. Do you feel like you have any kind of sense of solidarity with other Scottish people, or, you know, people in your?
No.
You have the opportunity to circle the wagons with your actual native, like, countrymen, or is that ship sunk?
Well, I don't live in Scotland, so I don't speak to Scottish people very often. But certainly, when I did live there, they were, you know, very drunk on modern ideas then, and I'm sure that it's even worse now. English people, pretty much the same. But, you know, that the thing is, most people are actually quite apolitical. They repeat what fashionable ideas that they've heard. They don't tend to weigh those ideas up and question them. They don't really care that much. Most people are occupied with the details of their own life. I honestly think that most people aren't that political by nature. And this is yet another reason why democracy is a joke. It's a sham. It's nonsense. And there are many other reasons as well, but that's one of them. And I think that this is, in a way, this is why progressivism quite naturally evolves into a moral system, into a religion, a quasi-religion, because that's what people actually want. Politics is like it's too impersonal. It's too meaningless to people, and it's too complicated for people, and it's too boring. It's dry. And also politics means that they have to think about things, and most people don't want to. They just want things to be simple for themselves, and that's fine. That's what most people are like. So I can see why progressivism has naturally morphed into that in order to really, and this is something the left did. They turned political issues into moral issues. That's a lesson that we could probably learn from. A lot of people on our side tend to think that we should do whatever, you know, the opposite of what our enemies did, what our opponents did. And I think we should learn and emulate them. Obviously not emulate their goals, but emulate their methods. And one of them was that they transformed political issues into moral issues so that it becomes the moral thing to, the only moral choice is to agree with the progressive. Otherwise, you're a racist or you're a homophobe or you're a transphobe, etc. But that all rests on morality. And this is how they can say that political correctness is just decency and wokery is just being a decent person. But it's not. It is. It's profoundly political. But because it has now taken on the livery of morality, that's the way it's perceived by people. It's like you can imagine the average normie saying, "Well, I don't want to be a bad person. I don't want to be racist. So of course I support BLM." Sure. Yeah. Anyway, let's wrap this one up now because I am starting to get tired. And yes. I have to maintain some energy for the last one.
You told me before we went live, Woes, that it's not everybody doesn't know how you do this, and it's a lot of fun. But I still think you're the marathon man. So,
oh, thank you.
I want to give you like a small paper cup of Gatorade as you run off to your next mile. But
well, thank you. That would be appreciated. I mean, this has been a very interesting discussion, and I'm glad that we've finally had a conversation. This is the first time that you and I have spoken. So thank you for appearing, and I hope this has been enjoyable for you. I think the viewers seem to have enjoyed it. It's been quite a lively discussion in the live chat.
Great. Well, Woes, it's been an absolute pleasure and a definite highlight to my 2021 and a great note to close the year out on for me. So let's definitely do it again.
Oh, I've just remembered that there are some questions. So we'll go through those quite quickly. Piers Taylor says, Merry Christmas, Woes, and makes a donation. Thank you very much for that, Piers. It's nice to see you again. I haven't seen you this year until now, so it's nice to know that you're still around. Okay, last things. You mentioned once when speaking to Thamster that you were going to watch Possession. It's an awesome movie. Have you seen it yet?
Oh, man. I have not. I don't know if you know the movie, Woes. I think it came out in the early 80s. It's with Sam Neill. It's like a horror film.
I've heard of it. It definitely rings a bell, but I don't think I've seen it.
What if you, me, and Tyler do like an Odyssey stream after we view it and we can deconstruct it?
Yeah, I'd be happy to do that. Yeah,
sure. Even though it was built, it was filmed in the early 80s. It's about how wokeism sucks and is stupid. So we can figure out how to tie those knots.
Right. Okay. That sounds quite good. And then Vampire Squid says, just checking in after a long day. That's nice. Thank you. It's good to have you on board. Bane of Crenshaw says, the wealth seeking and hyperconformity of the Catholic Church seems pathetic and very much like the woke left of today when compared to Martin Luther, who was totally unafraid and based on certain issues. So the wealth-seeking and hyper-conformity of the Catholic Church seems more, like the woke left of today, as compared with Protestantism. What would you say about that? Would you have any comment on that?
I guess, you know, I think most of the Catholic dissidents that I talk to, I think they certainly struggle with the leadership of the Catholic Church and sort of the direction that the church as a whole, like the political wing of the church is moving in a direction that a lot of people are not comfortable with.
Yes.
The Protestant, I mean, if there's one eternal struggle on the dissident right, that's greater than Nietzsche versus Christ, it's, you know, is wokeism the fault of Protestantism, or is wokeism the fault of Catholicism because Catholicism was so corrupt that it gave birth to Protestantism and so those will be, we will be here in millennial 2039 doing that and have that same super chat from somebody.
I wouldn't be surprised. And he also elaborates, the Protestant tradition seems more based because it was primarily concerned with truth, whereas the Catholics were concerned with maintaining structure and harmony between the different facets of that structure. Well, that goes into theological matters that I'm not familiar with, so I can't comment on that.
Yeah, I can't either. I guess I've just... my affinity towards Catholicism, I guess I've read more Catholic theology, and it's something that I think came, just kind of happened organically. G.K. Chesterton is also somebody that I would attribute with my move rightward a great deal. And then he led to other Catholic thinkers. And honestly, you know, who I read next or what direction I flow in just tends to be something that I can never really understand. It just flows naturally, and I have not been pushed in the direction of a lot of Protestant theology yet, so I'm not gonna elbow drop Protestantism that hard, since I haven't spent enough time with its heavyweights.
Right, yes, I understand. Hold on a second.
That progressivism is totally their fault.
Yeah. let's just go with that.
That was a jab.
And then Beau Sauvage said, MW writes the Mask Maiden's Tale. I think this is when we were talking about how there are no dramas that actually reflect the world that we're living in. I mean, I did a video, I've mentioned it before, I did a video in 2015 called The Dishonest Mirror, where I said this, that modern dramas don't reflect the world as it actually is, or people as they actually are. It's all it's very bland, or it's ideological. They're leftists, they're liberals. All of the characters in a drama are, you don't get, or if you do get someone who's right wing, they're a villain. They're a cartoon racist villain. You know, that's all. That's it. There's no depth. But I think frankly, I don't think the good characters have any depth either. I really think that the flight from truth and honesty and observation has brought with it a terrible shallowness about everything.
I mean, I agree, millennial, and I think that, I mean, I guess another angle or another thing that I think drove me to kind of create videos and do a lot of content creation is that I can't bring myself to watch television or movies anymore, right? There's so little worth watching that I just spend my time editing my own videos.
I'm not surprised. I mean, I watch stuff from the 70s. I just cannot stand modern cinema. I did watch a version of Macbeth from 2015 quite recently, and it was good. It was all right, you know. But I think I would prefer the version, Polanski's version from the early 70s. I watched that in high school, and I still have fond memories of it. You know, it was very atmospheric. I hate, and especially TV, especially British, like modern British TV, I absolutely abysmal.
The Distributives had a comment a little while ago that he felt like the golden age of television was bookended, but it began with The Sopranos and it ended with Game of Thrones. And literally last week, my wife and I just started rewatching The Sopranos because I was like, I might as well just return to beginning. Mm. At least The Sopranos was, you know, I guess I didn't watch the seasons, but it never struck me as getting too political when I was watching it.
No, definitely not. I think that's true for American TV, that there was a golden age in the 2000s. I guess maybe up to 2015 for American TV. But for British TV, you've got to go back to the 70s and 80s. The 90s, not really. It was a bit bland. The 2000s, it was starting to get Hollywoodized. And then the 2010s, it was getting paused. It was becoming ideologically, you know, progressive and commie, and now just horrendous. Anyway, let's end it there. So this has been a good one. I've enjoyed this. So thank you.
Thanks so much. Good luck with your next guest.
Thank you very much. I'll be back in about 10 minutes with Ryan Turnipseed. And in the meantime, this has been Last Things. Thank you for appearing on Millennial 2021.
It's a pleasure. Take care, everybody. Good night.
Okay. I'll see you all soon.
Millennial Woes has created many things, and this is your chance to own one of them. A unique piece of work handcrafted by the Vile Vlogger to commemorate Millennial 2021. 100 hours of highly skilled labor went into producing this animated vector graphic, which can be magnified to any size. In the iconic Millennial Woes font, it glistens and responds to your touch. And at the center of it all, a figure representative of 2021, the White Stag, symbolizing endurance, discovery, and rejuvenation. This one-of-a-kind creation is up for sale as an NFT. Follow the link below, and it can be yours forever. This is your only chance.